If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Kate Toome is a UK-based needlework and mixed media artist who is creating her own personal cosmology. This is the second part of our interview with Kate and, if you like, trigger warning, part of the conversation that we have today relates to the untimely passing of her husband, who died in 2021, which had a profound effect on Kate's creativity. As with the conversation that I had with Julie Heaton, Kate's story is very sensitive, it's very poignant, and clearly nothing that anybody would wish on another person. However, as with Julie's story, it's taken Kate in a creative direction, and she recognises that the work that she's making now wouldn't have been possible had she not gone through what she's gone through. We talk about a lot about her creativity, topics including the God of Crabs and the Salmon of Knowledge. How can you resist such a conversation? It is a meaningful conversation. It is quite a sensitive conversation. But Kate is willing to talk about these things and is also actively helping other people who are in similar situations. She's a force of nature. I love her work. I can't wait to see the pantheon of gods when they're fully realised. And I'm sure you'll enjoy this conversation. I'll be back next week with a chat with a different artist. And if you enjoy the show, if you're able to leave a review on your favourite podcast platform, that would be marvellous. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Enjoy the show. Do you feel that your masks are calling from certain traditions? Like, I feel like, and this is partly, I say this because I know that you've also had this environmental thing that we haven't talked about, but I feel like there's a certain, you've got pagan vibes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, is that, are you reinterpreting those, or do you feel like these are fresh ideas? Can you see how you're comprising them?
A bit of both. Yeah, a bit of both for sure. I mean, I'd probably have to wait until I've done all my kind of 13 to really look back and go, is there sort of an overarching concept? Like, are these facts? Because I variously will sort of think, oh, all the masks are self-portraits. All the masks are the face of my husband. All the masks are something, are just something else. They're someone else. There's something else that's, like we said earlier, that I'm like just bringing forth from the void, from the unseen forces. And I think, I can't remember if I said this earlier, but like the three pillars of my work have always been grief, transformation, and divinity. And I think it's like all artists, you know, I think when you make anything, it's within that thing that you've made is everything within you, all your influences, all your subconscious, like, you know, subconscious thoughts, feelings, interests kind of come through. It's kind of in what proportion have they been manifested? I wouldn't say that there's, I mean, like, for example, like with this rabbit trickster mask, there's obviously some very sort of specific ideas that I want to play around with within that tradition. So obviously, you know, I know about the trickster gods. I've read widely about, you know, all kind of pantheons throughout, you know, the global culture. I'm very, I mean, this is why I want to hopefully get this funding so I can do a lot more research into kind of different traditions that use masks and masquerade across the world. I'm very interested in sort of, I'm very anti-imperialist and very into sort of decolonizing the West and like the Western, you know, interrogating kind of Western imperialism and things like that. And so that was obviously, like I said, much more present in my work prior. Now I think it's just a lot more, what's the word, kind of, it's much more integral without being quite so loud.
Yeah. All right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So for a long time, it's like you were saying this is what it's about, but now it just is that you've wrapped your work around those themes so much that you don't need to show. It's almost like maybe the foundations of a well-built house. After a while, you don't need to go on about how well the foundations are now. You just carry on building.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I totally think that. And I think it's possibly also just about the fact, like, I'm 44 this year. I think, you know, I've been doing embroidery. I mean, I sort of think of, like, 2013 as, like, the time that I really sort of started working. So it's been, you know, over 10 years. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely been that evolution of, like, I don't feel so much like I need to say something quite so explicitly. That hasn't just kind of clicked over. I think that's been a progression that sort of, like, I've felt more as my confidence has grown and my voice has become clearer, I have felt less need to shout so loudly with the work. I feel like it's much more comfortable with it just being up to you to interpret.
Yeah, you don't have to apologize for it, do you? You can just let it be. And that takes, you said, I think that takes, time spent making the things, isn't it, to be sure. Let's talk about the God of Crabs, right? That was what it's called, isn't it?
God of Crabs.
I love the fact that you're like, so it's making these little things and underneath the surface, a giant crab. Can you remember when the God of Crabs first popped into your mind?
I can. I was in a pub in Lewis having a Sunday roast and I can't remember who I was with, but Nikki Marsden was there and I remember just saying, this is what I'm going to do next. I don't care. My mum had been very in my ear about, well, you can never make money doing embroidery because, you know, it takes so long and you have to charge for your time. And I was really haunted by this and I'd really like internalised this idea. And then at that point I was like, fuck that, I don't give a shit, I'm gonna get on with this crab that I want to do. And I think it was just because it promised a lot in terms of texture, which I'm obsessed with, and color, and just I could really like turn it up. I could really use like unnatural colors and just really play with it and put all the textures and beads and stuff in it and push myself.
I think it's interesting, just before we go on, that like you say, that whole you've got to make money from embroidery is almost the same version of you've got to make art that is drawing, isn't it? It's a funny thing, that whereas it's just another way of like holding you back a little bit. And I'm sure your mum wasn't doing that on purpose. She was just being pragmatic about it, right? But...
No, totally. But I also think, you know, I mean, what is school if not a factory for making little workers? I feel like the capitalist, it's very capitalist and very, you know, you've got to be commercial, you've got to be productive, otherwise there's no value, you have to be able to make something that will sell, and art has always subverted that, definitely, and we know that, that's not a new idea. But for someone who is like working in a corporate retail job and like thinking, I don't want to do this, I'd like to be able to make money from my creativity, like how do I transition, I don't know, with very little confidence in my own creativity at that point. I was very vulnerable to those ideas. I was very like a sponge. I was like, yes, obviously I need to try and make money out of it. Obviously I need to be faster, or I need to make it small enough so that people can afford to buy it and stuff like that. And I think that's also something that is a bit of a fault of the whole kind of textiles or embroidery as craft, because I think in the craft world, you know, there's a lot more, you know, where textiles and embroidery sits within craft, there's a lot more of those influences of sort of, you want to have an Etsy shop and you want to have things that sell and maybe you need to make kits. And I've done it. I've had kits myself. I still do have kits. how can you commodify your artistry in a way? How can you package it up and product it up? And I think there's always, you know, we still have to live in the world. We still have to live in this capitalist system. We still have to eat. So, you know, we do have to kind of try and make that work. But for me, again, it's been a sort of gradual process of throwing off that desperate priority of like capitalist production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's quite hard, isn't it? Because that's the way the world turns and that's the way you're meant to think. I mean, without going into too much detail, does your art support you now, or are you still being supported by other streams of income?
God, yeah. No, it doesn't. I still have a free. I work 3 days a week in a workers' co-op, which I love, and I wouldn't give it up. I'd like to go down to 2 days a week. Really, I think that'd be enough. But I am much more like I, you know, apply for funding, apply for prizes, I teach, and I've made more money, you know, from teaching. I obviously do sell my work, but it's never going to be a reliable income. I feel very strongly about pricing your work correctly. But what is that even? It's really, really difficult. It's always really hard to think, well, what can somebody afford? Like, what does that mean? You know, I couldn't afford to buy my own work. I don't know anybody in my social circle who could afford to buy artwork. And that's really tricky. How do you go about it? So it's a hodgepodge of things. Mm. It's teaching, it's funding,
But giving yourself the permission to throw the monetary concerns away is like unshackling your scale, right?
Yeah. And that's a huge privilege as well. And like, let's be real. When I was married, you know, we had two incomes, so I could afford to not work full time because we could make it work as a unit. A lot of people can't do that, so I, you know, I'm always really conscious of like not making it seem like I'm going, don't worry about that, just make whatever you want, money doesn't matter. Because it's like, well, that's just really privileged, and people should be empowered to make art no matter what their economic status is. You know, I would never want to represent an idea that like people could just do, you know, so it's just not true. Like, yeah, I don't make a lot of money, but I can't not make art.
Yeah, there's definitely a balance to be found, isn't there, between the, like, you know, follow your dreams, but at the same time, you know, let's keep our feet on the ground a little bit. I remember once there's a productivity YouTuber who I quite liked, and she was just like, so I like to get up at like 5 a.m. and, you know, all of that stuff. And you're like, I'm going to give you a child and then I'm going to see what bloody happens. You got no chance.
Yeah.
Die.
Yeah,
so when did The God of Crabs come out? I was trying to find it.
Yeah. So that came out in 2013, 14.
Right. And then you definitely meandered into the world of nature. And you got funding, right, to do some research, is that right?
Yeah, so I've been twice now, but I did an arts residency in Costa Rica in 2020. Yeah, beginning of 2020. Mm. And I went again last year, end of 2022, went again.
And the body of work was definitely, you were looking at environmental, I'm just going to say that. You're just looking at environmental. But can you explain what the body of work was, the way it was going at that time?
Yeah, so I was really looking into how I would generally work is I would have a sort of overarching idea, and that year, for a year, I would kind of make work around that year. So it started off looking at memorializing extinct species, and then using that as a way of like telling like how these species have become extinct. And then as I became more informed and more sophisticated around that, that transformed into looking at ways that kind of Western imperialism, or, you know, systems of oppression, white supremacy, have threatened indigenous life ways, or indigeneity in general, which I'm very interested in and very passionate about, indigeneity and indigenous culture, and just sort of interrogating some of these ideas that we're given around conservation and sort of the colonialism of conservation. For example, you know, the idea of like the national park that charities like WWF are very sort of keen and shout loudly about. You think, so that's a great idea. Yeah, we should totally like preserve this piece of land for animals that are endangered in this ecosystem. But it doesn't actually talk about the fact that there are indigenous people that have lived in this, on this piece of land for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's their ancestral lands. And they may have practices like they maybe eat bushmeat. Oh, that's awful. We should totally stop that. That's awful. How dreadful that they're eating monkeys that are endangered. But it's like, okay, but whom does that narrative serve? It probably serves the loggers and the oil companies and the miners that have like reduced that habitat down so much so that now we can't afford for these indigenous people to eat one monkey or one iguana a year or whatever it is. Like in Costa Rica, there's hardly any indigenous people, but iguana is kind of part of their traditional diet. But the sort of narrative that we get sold as Westerners is like, that's terrible, we must educate them to not do that. And it's like, okay, but how have we got to that point? That's what's not being told to us, is that these big corporations and these big systems of like wealth extraction and extractive capitalism have come in and gone, we're going to take 99% of this rainforest. And all the people that lived in there, all the tribes, have to now live on this 1%, and they're trying to still eke out their traditional ways of life, which have been in balance with the ecosystem for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, actually, and not causing any destruction or any imbalances whatsoever. And maybe we as Westerners should not be quite so clutching our pearls when we hear of people eating bushmeat or using animal products or whatever. Because it's our systems that have really destroyed that. So that was what my art was interrogating. That was what the art was about, the animal portraits that I was doing.
I love that. Yeah, you feel like the indigenous people, we used to eat those monkeys because there were so bloody many of them that they needed to try and keep the numbers down, isn't it? It's not like they've gone, I know, I'm in the mood for some really endangered food today.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's bonkers, isn't it? It's such a complex system, isn't it, when you get into it? And I think it can feel quite overwhelming as well. Have you come to your own conclusions about like, what is there a pragmatic solution for you?
God, no. I mean, for me personally, like, I'm a vegan and I live my life in a way. Generally now I'm like, how can I do the least harm? That's just sort of how I try to sort of focus my decisions on, how can I do the least harm, whatever that means, including to myself. But no, like, I think one of the privileges of being an artist is I can ask the questions and I can invite the viewer to ask the questions, but I don't have the answers. But I think it's more about raising awareness, raising consciousness of like the stories that we're told, the stories that are most loudest, and the narratives that are sort of presented as the solutions, like just having a bit of critical thinking around it. And that's what I definitely don't have the answers. I think in 2024, a lot of the solutions that would be great it's just too late. I think there's just a lot of things that would have been awesome like a few decades ago, would have really, really made a difference. But now it's like, yeah, no, I mean, if we've only got 30 of this particular monkey left, then we probably do need to talk to the indigenous people. And I don't know, do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know how we, I think a lot of this stuff is on a very fine edge.
Yeah. And maybe sometimes all we can do is just offer up the questions, because if it's not necessarily for us to find the answers, but at least if we ask the questions, somebody might get the answers.
Mm-hmm. And it's listening as well. I think it's listening as well, because actually, like, we lived the indigenous life ways have kind of been they've worked for thousands of years.
Yeah,
like we've lived this way under sort of capitalism and sort of monotheism and things like that for like 2,000 years. But we were this exact anatomical species for hundreds of thousands of years, or at least, you know, tens and tens of thousands of years. So we were doing that for much longer, and the world was like not overheating and having crazy weather, and you know what I mean, like, we,
it's quite hard not to get too depressed about it, kind of, isn't it? Because you're just like, oh, humanity. I you know, my kids are 6 and 4, and a lot of the time my conversations just go, now I'm sorry girls, but generally humanity are idiots. We've been idiots for a good few hundred years now, and we haven't really got past ourselves to fix it or whatever. I was interested though, you did a piece about a salmon, the divine salmon of knowledge. Yeah, and I used to be a fishmonger, and I feel like there's stuff I don't know about the salmon. I wanted you to tell me about salmon.
Do you know about the salmon of knowledge?
I don't. I didn't know that there was a salmon of knowledge until about 3 days ago.
So in the Mabinogion, which is the Welsh cycle of myth that we have, one of the things I'm very sad about is that we don't have extant, we don't know about our indigenous people in the UK, in England, because the Romans came a lot, you know, we were invaded a lot, we were colonized really early on, so we don't have a lot of that, we didn't write it down, so we don't know. But the Mabinogion is the Welsh, is the oldest kind of Welsh mythos that we have. And it's, you know, even that is dubious, because it would have been like translated and probably, you know, and the only writing was being done by Christians and things like that. But one of the stories we have is the Salmon of Knowledge, and it's where the knights went on a quest, and they wanted to find the oldest animal with all the knowledge, and they go to all these different animals. Eagle is one of them, and the stag is one of it, and they end up finding this pool with the salmon, and it's the oldest animal and it has all of the knowledge. And I'm gonna get it messed up now, because I haven't read this story for a long time, but there was hazel, it's a hazel grove, and so there were hazel, if you ate the hazelnut that had fallen in the water, you'd like have all the knowledge. But that piece that I did was just also looking at salmon as a species, and just how amazing salmon are, the fact that they can change their physiology to breathe salt water and fresh water, and the amazing journey that they do to breed it back in exactly the same river that they started off as. But again, how Indigenous people and First Nations people of Canada and North America, whole cultures, whole forests, that's the title of the piece, was I am the trees and I am you. Because the carbon and the phosphorus and the minerals in the bones of the salmon are literally in the soil that the trees have grown up out of, and this whole culture has kind of risen out of that had been there for centuries and centuries. And now, because of kind of damming and pollution and industrialization and things like that, like these incredible complex webs, complex ecosystems, just can't exist. And this is just such a magical creature. Like, nature is magic, like magic is real, you know, like there's so much, you know, incredible stuff on this planet, like it's amazing.
Yeah, shame about the humans,
right.
So you're doing all this work, and then your husband died. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, I totally can. Yeah, totally.
What happened?
Yeah, so I was in Costa Rica in January 2020, and when I got back, we just started hearing about COVID-19, and then that horrible year kind of happened, and you know, all of that. And then in the November, about October, he started having this pain. And my husband Nicky was a triathlete. He'd done an Ironman in 2019. Like, he was super fit, healthy, no lifestyle factors and no family history at all. But basically, when he ended up in hospital with these pains, they'd found that he'd already was at stage 4 with cancer in his liver, colon cancer that had metastasized within his liver. So there was never any option. There was never any chance for him that it was incurable. Like, it was like, we're going to, you know, try and give you as long as we can. but there's no chance of us being able to operate on it. Or so it was like, yeah. And they originally said, you know, maybe 2 years, but he was dead in 7 months.
Shit.
That's tragic.
Well, and obviously, yeah, you said right at the start that that made a massive difference in terms of your creativity. I mean, how long were you just out of it for? When do you feel like you started coming back into the world again? Because...
So I mean, it rearranged me completely as a person, and everything about me and my life, and you know, is completely different now. And the shock and the trauma of it is just, you know, massive. I didn't all the kind of creative. Well, so what happened initially is that when I was in Costa Rica, I met this snake, and I made this piece about this snake. We can come back to this later. It's a good story. So I kind of came back, and I was in the middle of making that snake when Nikki was diagnosed. So I finished that, and it was quite cathartic because of what this snake represented. And so I finished that piece, and that was the last animal portrait that I've done. And that's hanging on my bedroom wall. I kept that piece, and that's hanging on my bedroom wall. And that was called Instinct is Worth a Thousand Years of Memory. And then after that, I was like, I just don't have any creativity in me. I don't have any juice in me. But then I felt like I needed to do something, make something. So I made these three cushions, which I call my grief pillows. And they are, and I went right back to cross stitch. So I basically bought cotton crochet thread and charted out these three sort of samplers, really. And they were my grief pillows. The first one I did was had a quote from Gandalf in it, where he says, all we have to do is decide what to do with the time that is given us. And then the second one had a quote, which I'm not going to get wrong, which is from this, the founder of Reiki.
Do you want me to read
Japanese
it?
Japanese master.
Says, just for today, I will let go of anger. I will let go of worry. I will count my many blessings. I will do my work honestly. I will be kind to every living creature. Dr. Uzui, I guess.
Dr. Uzui, thank you. Yes, thank you, Jamie. Yes. So that one. And then the final one, which was no loss, only change. Yeah, I just did those. I could sit on the sofa with Nikki when he was having chemo. We could just watch TV and be together. And I could make these pillows. And so I have them. They're all in my bedroom now. And yeah, they were sort of the recipients, the containers of my grief and my tears and my sweat on my hands. And so that's what I made during that time. Mm. And then I actually did start the first mask just before Nikki died. And the first two masks that I made were the Oak King and the Holly King. The first one I made was this frog one, which is really weird, and I still really love it. And I might remake that one at some point. But that was like a liminal kind of toad god of death mask. But then I made the Oak King and the Holly King, and those are the ones that I feel are like really, really symbolic of my grief and of Nikki himself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting. The path started like pretty much straight away, almost as though there's always been a channel. Like you've always had this stuff as a channel for processing yourself. I was just looking at those masks now, and you can see like, yeah, there is a protection there. There's a real, but interesting that you still carried on with that. Like, even though you said, it changed everything, you know, you can't really categorize what goes on there, but it's interesting that you still managed to carry on and make some work and find a way to express yourself in this kind of like abstract way, I guess, isn't it? It's like making the thing, not really knowing what you're saying, just making some moves, making some energy move or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's got to come out, really. And I think it's a way of processing what you can't, it's sort of saying what can't be said.
Mm. when I talked to Julie Heaton, right, so she did a series of work. She was heading in a particular direction and she was doing her textile work, but not necessarily taking it massively seriously. And then her husband died and she started doing machine embroidery because that had been a thing that she'd appreciated in the past. And she started doing pieces of work that were like a car engine, various objects that she did. And that was, and then after a while, she managed to do some more figurative pieces. But then she went and did an MA at the Royal College of Art, I think, a Royal Academy, and did a completely different format. She just did a different type of work, but she ended up naming the work with phrases that were really reflective of her grief. Like, you know, why, I can't remember what they were called, but it was almost like, why didn't I say these words while you were still around? Those kind of things, you know, and almost like she got to a point where she was able to communicate that. And from that point was then able to bring that idea back into the other mode of work that she was doing with the machine embroidery. And she quite overtly says, you know, the tragedy that happened is the thing that's defined her as an artist. And it feels like, I just wondered, you know, what your take on that is.
No, 100%. I mean, I think, you know, that kind of loss, I think of it sometimes as like, it's like a big backpack that I can never take off. And it's really heavy. Sometimes it's much heavier. But it's also like a room opens inside of you that was not available to you before. And within that is all this other stuff. And, you know, it's not 3 years, it's not been 3 years yet, and I still do question a bit less now, but when people say, oh, it's better to have loved and lost than never loved at all, and I still question, like, is it? Because it's really fucking shit to have had a love of your life die so young and so horribly. And I do question those kind of things. And luckily I don't have people in my life who would say such platitudes, but they are out there. One of the things that I hope to sort of explore with the work that I'm making now as well is just how awful, how bad we are at talking about death and grief, and how bad that makes it for people who suffer loss. Because you really do have to teach people how to talk to you. You really have to teach people how to be around you, because people are so frightened of death and grief and they don't know what to say. One of the things that drives my work now very much is like, I want to help people who are grieving, which I think is everybody in one way or another. But for people who have loss or are going through loss or will experience loss, to have better tools to carry that, to feel that, to express it. And even to the point of like, I could totally see a potential destiny of the masks as healing tools, where people can put on different aspects of this cosmology, this pantheon, to feel, to like think, right, what, how can I be different? How can I, you know, voice something that if I didn't feel like I could voice it, but I can with a mask on, or I can see an aspect of myself that I couldn't see before, or I feel uncomfortable with myself, but with a mask on, I can somehow open something up. It's a very uncomfortable and complicated gift. I know that I'm could never have been the artist that I am now without what I've gone through. And that makes it very difficult, because you think you could just it's very much like you were on a path and then the path split. And then there's the you that would have been you if Nikki hadn't died, and I'd have carried on living in the house that we were going to grow old together in and die, and carried on making animal portraits, or carried on doing that. And then there's the me that's now, and I've worked so hard to pick up every little piece of my broken heart and build a life again, my second best life, the life that is available to me now. But and it's very complicated to feel like I'm really proud of me, I'm really proud of this work, or And you just always have that conflict of like, I couldn't have done that without Nikki dying.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Julie probably says the same thing as well. You know, it's like she's proud of her work, but it comes with a cost. Thanks for talking about that, though, because it's never easy. I don't really want to.
Pleasure. No, but I can talk about it. And I think it's important for people who can talk about it to talk about it, because people who hear it, it can do. I know from teaching, I've taught a mask class with textile artists, and I did it about making masks for emotional expression. And some of the responses I had were just like, because I mentioned, you know, I talked about my loss in that as well. And just from, you know, these people all around the world, some people were just like, oh, I had never thought about that and I didn't really want to do it, but then I made a mask and it was about this and it really changed something for me. And I just was like, wow, like that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And then right at the start, you were saying about the masks having sigils. And then you also made reference to Dr. Yuzui and Reiki. And I'm Reiki, I was going to say Reiki adjacent. Technically, I'm a Reiki master. But, you know, I know that symbols and those kind of things are part of that process as well. And it's all just, yeah, sometimes you can't express things. It's a shame that, considering death is one of those things we 100% know is going to happen. Like you say, just don't have the vocabulary, do you? But then it's interesting that maybe symbols and masks provide a vocabulary for something that you can't really put into words.
Well, yeah. And I think it's almost like it's all to play for, because even though, you know, we think about birth and there's just so much out there. It's so visible, you know, doulas and midwives you know, baby things. And, you know, obviously for obvious reasons, you know, that's so visible and so accessible, but not everybody has children. But everybody is going to die and everybody will definitely be in a relationship with somebody who is going to die. Mm. No question. But, you know, we had a death doula and, like, so many people are like, what? And it's like, yeah, there's just so much about death that people, it's just hidden. And that's obviously intentional. And I'm kind of interested in, like, that's probably not how it should be. That's not very healthy.
Yeah. That's a whole conversation for another podcast. Don't get us talking about assisted suicide. But do you know what I mean? I feel like, yeah, we good on you humans once again. So you said you're in the middle of a mask and then there's another mask that creeped up. One question I've got, actually, just before that, on a technical standpoint, if you're making a really big piece, there's always that dark bit where you're just like, oh, for God's sake, you know, I'm still going through this. The initial joy is over. The joy of finishing is quite a way off. Do you have like little side projects that you do to keep you buzzing along the way, or do you just push on through?
Yeah, no, I just push on through. I mean, that pink moth mask, that's the biggest moth that I've made. And God, that just took so long. And pink is so difficult to work with, I discovered, the right tone of pink. And I did so much unpicking on that mask and so much like buying of trimmings and buying of like rubber tubing and buying of different kind of iridescent pink sequins and just being like, no, that's not right. Or putting, you know, stitching things down and taking it off. That was a difficult one to bring through. But no, I don't. I kind of envy people who have these sort of multiple, but I've never been like that. I'm very like, I just need to just focus on this one piece.
Interesting. So yeah, and that, I mean, that moth piece is, in some ways, it reminds me of some of those massive old lampshades, because it's got all the fringing and stuff, right, like that, isn't it? But it is a bit like that. You're like, oh my God, it's an old lady lampshade size, for the listeners out there. So what's on what's on the horizon? What pieces are coming out next?
I mean, I haven't shared. I've been really bad and I haven't shared a lot on Instagram. I'm actually getting my website redesigned and sort of so I can kind of relaunch a little bit and kind of tidy up my public, you know, the window. Mm-hmm. So there's a few that haven't been shown yet. So there's the crone mask, which was in the Hand and Lock, which I haven't really shown a lot of pictures around that. So that one's going to be shown. And then, yeah, this I've also made this purple, really tall purple mask, which was initially inspired by ideas around the cosmic dancer. Of like Shiva, and the kind of cycles of life and death and birth and rebirth. And but then I was making it over last summer, and I was starting to have like really bad insomnia, like really bad, and just was feeling like very crazy. And so it kind of became a bit like night terror. So it's quite a formidable kind of, it's got three sets of eyes, and it's very sort of swirly whirly purple. Yeah, so that is that one, which I haven't got any photographs of yet. So that one, the Empress mask, which I've talked about, which is coming out, and then yeah, and then I'll do the rabbit trickster. I've got an idea to do a kind of crocodile god one. When I was in Costa Rica last year, or in 2022, end of 2022, we did this, we went on this boat trip, and I've never seen real wild crocodiles before. I mean, you know, many people will have seen them in zoos or aquarium or whatever, but actually seeing them like really wild, like really did something to me. Like it really, it was really thrilling and really terrifying. And just, there was just something about them, seeing them in the wild, that kind of clicked into place of like, fucking hell, they're really old. Like they've been here for a long, long, long time. And like looking at them in the eye and knowing that like they're completely in charge here. Like they're completely powerful, super seriously powerful. And if you put one foot in this river, they would be, it would be over for you like that. And I had that was a similar experience that I had with the snake that I mentioned in Costa Rica, of like the second time in my life, I suppose, where I've been really close up to something that could just end my life. And just the power of that.
They're also very dinosaur-y, aren't they? Crocodiles, like the most. You did a piece, 2019, you did a piece about, is it a Chinese crocodile?
The Chinese alligator, yeah, okay. The most endangered alligator. Yeah, I love that piece. Still available to buy, by the way.
I love that these ideas keep coming. It'll be interesting to see when you get to number 13, what the logical, you know, what the idea is for idea, yeah. If you like, number 14, but not necessarily in that sequence, right. You know, whether suddenly you find you've got to write a book or you've got to put on a play or something or other. It feels like this.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to pivot now to the four important questions. Are you ready?
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Very good. Right. So. Do you have a favourite band?
No.
Brilliant. Next, do you listen to music while you're working?
I don't. I listen to audiobooks while I'm working.
Right.
I'm currently listening to a book called Mortality by Christopher Hitchens, what he wrote when he had cancer.
He died, right?
Did he die?
Yeah.
I've also just finished, I'm kind of in the middle of The Science Delusion by Rupert Sheldrake, which is kind of a rebuttal or a sort of response to The God Delusion, which I also read recently, which I love. I'm very into audiobooks, but musically, I love hip hop and the drum and bass and a lot of other things. Okay. But that's my main musical.
So you listen to, because I find like with audiobooks, you got to be in the right headspace. Like if I'm driving and I'm concentrating, but not a ton, then it's okay to listen to books. I guess that's the same then when you're stitching, right? And you're working, that probably is a good way to manage the process.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So following on from that then, do you have a favourite book? Because, I mean, you've talked about the audio books. So I'm guessing you consume quite a lot in your research as well.
I do consume a lot of books. I was thinking about this question and I was like, I can't really say I don't have a favourite book, but I would say like the favourite book that I've read recently, or the most memorable book that I've read recently, was by John Allegro, and it's called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And I think it came out in the 70s, and it's been pretty sort of ravaged as sort of pseudoscience, but I found it absolutely fascinating. He kind of posits that Jesus was a mushroom, and pretty much everything in the Bible really means it's a penis. It was just like, wow. And how he's written it is he's like gets into the etymology of the words So he's saying, well, actually, when this book, when the Bible was written, it was like, it would be, you know, the Hebrew, in the Aramaic word, this actually means this, or this, in the ancient Greek, it actually means this. And so sort of really kind of goes that, Christianity came out of a fertility cult, and that the red and white spotted fly agaric mushroom, which is, you know, found everywhere, is like this magical, that's really it. They were all taking the mushroom and kind of having these trips and seeing God and like communicate and expanding their consciousness, and that's really what Jesus was, a mushroom.
I like it.
Listeners may be able to guess why I like it.
Did you ever watch the TV show Lost?
Yeah.
There was an episode of that, and I can't remember the details, but it was almost like there was one episode where they tried to say that the whole thing was just one person's imagination. And it would have been such a good way to have ended it, but it's a bit like that, isn't it? It's like, if what actually, the whole of the Bible was just this guy who got really mashed out and just wrote loads down, and then the next day couldn't remember any of it, but by God, what he'd written. I like it. And then, have you got a favourite film?
Again, let me think of a film that I've seen recently that I really love, because I don't have favourites. I think just because I could just consume a lot of art stuff.
Yeah.
I watch a lot of documentaries. I've gotten more into films again recently. The film that I saw, I saw a couple of weeks ago, which I was just like, I've never cried so loudly at a film, and it was 12 Years a Slave, which I know is not a new film, but okay. I've never seen it before. And I think what made me think, what I think, just something about like Steve McQueen's kind of like cinematography of it, and the kind of the some of the shots, just the sort of unflinching connection with like Chiwetel Ejiofor's performance of Solomon Northup, just the real visceral kind of look. And I know now, it, you know, things have moved on quite a bit, and then obviously aware that, you know, there's a strong narrative around, we know we do need to have more films about Black people and Black culture that's not just about them being enslaved. But I've actually never seen a slave film before, a film about enslaved people before. And I thought, yeah, I'm gonna watch it. And I just was like, God. I just think something about, I can't really say any better, really, just how just unflinching it is.
It's pretty amazing, though.
Really moving.
When a film can do that to you, eh? You know, I love it. Every now and again, you just get one, don't you? And you just, like, about a week later, you're still like, that film, man.
Yeah, and I do. That's how I felt about it. And it's, but I think also just because I was like, this is like people who are alive today's grandparents. Like, it's so near. It's just so near. Like, it's so recent. And that to me is just, it feels, that's just so horrifying.
Cool, man. Apart from the slavery, very not cool. But no, do you know what I was thinking about? There's a film I watched a little while ago called After Sun that's got Paul Mescal in it, who everybody seems to love at the moment. And the ending of that, you know, it's about a seen through the eyes of a girl who's maybe like 12 or something, and she's gone on holiday with her dad, and obviously her parents are split up, so she's just with her dad, and he's obviously quite a troubled man in one reason or another. And just the way the ending happens as well, it's just one of those things. And again, maybe I'm a dad, so maybe that's why it's triggering me a little bit more or something, but just one of those films where just a few days later you're still just like, fucking hell, that film.
Yeah,
art for you. We like that. Right. So,
yeah.
Final question then. This is going to be an interesting one. Is there an interesting fact about Katie Tune that not a lot of people know?
The problem is I'm quite an open person, but I think now I kind of said this at the start of the podcast, so now everybody who's listening does know. But the thing that I think I've been thinking about most certainly in context of like Katie Tune the artist, what do people not know, is the witchcraft. So I have a weekly altar ritual practice. I'm very, you know, that I'm really engaged with, and I'm very, it's always been there ever since I was about 16 or 17, I started. But I've been, you know, I've lapsed over the years. It's not, you know, it's been in, it's kind of come and gone, but it's currently very present. And when I did this course in Berlin last year, a lot of the people on this course were also witches, and it was very interesting to just think about art as a magical practice, and to then realize like that how many women have used art as a magical practice. So many artists. And I remember one of the women on this course had said, like, they were actually a Wiccan, so I'm not a Wiccan. They were like a level 3 initiated Wiccan, they said, and they were hereditary witch, and they said, oh, you know, but have to be really careful about saying that because people can be very discriminatory about it. And it just had never occurred to me. And I think it's possibly, and I think it's true, like, that I'll probably lose some followers, you know, by people who will think it's demonic or it's too challenging or whatever. But it's just definitely a worldview that I have always, it's always been a personal thing, not private, like I'm keeping it secret, but it's also been like just a personal practice that I have. But I think that the path for me ahead artistically is that that will come more into the work more and more. I mean, look at it.
Yeah. Do you think Wiccan is an indigenous religion for where you're at?
No, I mean, it isn't. Objectively, it's not. Wiccan is not an indigenous religion because it was invented by a man in the 50s. But I think it does attempt to bring in kind of as much of that kind of folk knowledge that is indigenous. You know, the cunning man and the cunning woman and the kind of folk magic that we definitely have in this country. And that's where I kind of lean. That's definitely more true. I think ultimately it's about just having a personal relationship with divinity. Is what it comes down to for me. It's called witchcraft because of the way that it looks externally and the tools that I use, but for me it's like the sea is God. Like walking into the sea, I live right on the beach nearly. Walking into the sea is like connects me with something that is just so primal and ancient and seriously powerful. And you just think, yeah, this is magic. This is like real, real powerful forces.
I like it. Yeah, I've a bit of a Taoist leaning as well, and I feel like that's similarly inclined. You know, it's just connected with nature in a quite nice way. One more thing, then I want to hear the story about the snake.
Right. So I was in Costa Rica in 2020, and I was perpetually delighted by the jungle. I'd never been so up close to, like, every day it was giving gifts, delighting us with toucans and parrots and vultures and just amazing frogs and all of this. So in the mornings I would go for a little walk around this beautiful hilly landscape at dawn, all the birds singing, monkeys are out, and I'd gone to the bottom of this sort of valley and there was a stream and there was just this snake just curled up just there, just out, just not covered up. And I was like, oh, amazing. So I got closer and closer to it very respectfully to try and take pictures of it. Didn't move. Got pretty close. Wasn't until the last day of this trip that I was flicking through a field guide and discovered that this snake was actually the most dangerous, volatile, aggressive, unpredictable snake in Central America, the Fer de Lance snake. And it 100% could have gone and struck out and bit me. No doubt I was absolutely close enough to do that. And I just couldn't stop thinking about this snake. And obviously many listeners will know that, like, snakes have huge rich mythology all over the world, and one of the things is transformation. And I very much felt like it was a harbinger of complete and total transformation in my life, because ever since I saw that snake, everything completely dissolved around me and has now been and is in the process of being remade.
It's a great story. Yeah, that must have
been. I have it tattooed on my arm.
Do you?
Yes, life size.
And that piece, I mean, the snake piece is really beautiful as well. As again, it's quite sort of mother of pearly kind of colours. It's quite a lot of like gold work, but it's not in gold, isn't it? There's a lot of that couching.
Yeah, it's pink. It's pink couching of, yeah, bloody hell. That was a lot of work, yeah.
Just sitting there with the devil, just stitching him. Amazing. Well,
yeah.
Hey, Katie. Thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Thanks, Jamie. It was great.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NEEDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.